Well, thank you so very much for the beautiful offertory music, the loving and very meaningful special music today as well. How many of you are familiar with the song from years ago, Joshua Fought the Battle of Jericho? Okay. Depending on the part of the country, you may have heard it sung just a little bit differently with pronunciation, but the message is the same nonetheless. How much do you know about ancient Jericho? You know, one of the few, I'd say few, regrets that I had when visiting Israel in, you know, recent years is that I did not have access to Jericho. Now, my wife went years earlier, you know, as part of that first archaeological dig at Jerusalem and got to see Jericho because it was available, was under Israeli control back then. But all that changed in about 1994, and the Palestinian organization took over control of that. So you go there now, you can drive by on the highway, and you look off, depending on where you're coming from, going either to the right or off to the left, and see the small village or small town. The estimate that I've read for population today is only 5,000. But Jericho has a lot of significance to you and to me. It's one of those cities. You think about the days of unleavened bread, and it's among the places, whether a city, you know, Sodom, Gomorrah, a nation like Egypt, or a small town or possible city from years ago, Jericho. The Bible's actually replete with instruction as well as exhortation regarding coming out of sin. And I was thinking about this the other day when I was dutifully trying to get every last crumb, you know, out of the crevices and places that are so hard to reach. I needed a much more powerful vacuum that would go not only down but over and in and out, you know, just suck all that stuff out of there. And I think it's humidity that one thing you can blame it on, that little gritty pieces. And, you know, it's not all leaven, but some of it to be leaven. You know, there's little tiny grains of sand or whatever, kind of grit. And some of that is hard to get just with the suction power of a vacuum cleaner. But if you're doing carpet, then oftentimes you can rub over that, if you could reach all those places to rub over it and loosen it and extract it. Well, there's something about this that we could really kind of throw ourselves into this. And you know, we're going to do all these things. I repented years ago of baptizing that old toaster that we had and never bought a new one lest I'd be tempted to do that again. But, you know, I got frustrated that one year because I vacuumed it, trying to get everything out. And I looked down and I thought I could see sin, you know, symbolically. I thought I could see pieces. And I hadn't had sand in there. I'd had pieces of bread in there toasted it during the year. So I'm not so much on the toast, I guess. I get by without a toaster anyway. If I had one today, I think I could resist immersing it in water and cleaning it, because an electrical appliance like that doesn't work well later, you know, if you do that. Take quite a miracle on that. Don't think I get a miracle for that kind of thing. So, but some of us have been striving now for a number of years. Would you believe some for a number of decades? We have some at 3 decades, 4 decades, 5 decades. And a couple folks that are close to 6 decades, I think, since coming into the knowledge of God's truth and about the days of unleavened bread and the other items, and, you know, busily in this job of putting sin out of our lives. And we focus on it during the time of the days of unleavened bread. But we are enjoined, we are exhorted to do this throughout the year in terms of the battle against sin. But it does seem to me that it's in a way easier to get the stuff out, as far as the physical things anyway, than it is to keep it out. I was cleaning one of the vehicles the other day, and the wind was blowing. After all, it's Oregon. The wind blows a lot, right? Well, the wind was blowing, and as I used the vacuum cleaner, a car wash, and it's sucking up the things, and it's looking good. Here came this breeze, and this stuff came in and blew in the back seat. And some of it looked like leaven. How can that be? Well, I said, I better not take any chances. I better do this again. So it may not have had any leaven, and it may have just been, things. There are things from the trees, leaves, and all sorts of little things that can blow around. But the battle against sin is relentless. It is, it continues. But in some ways, it seems like the energy can be more to put it out of our lives than it is to keep it out. We heard a brief reference to that in Mr. Kessler's sermonette as well. That when the days end, we've been through that. And if we're not careful, we can let down in our guard in this battle against sin. Well, let's return for a moment to this situation with Jericho. Jericho and the days of unleavened bread, it's quite a story. The story of Jericho was not and is not simply a great historical biblical event. It was that plus much more. The riveting account that we read in the book of Joshua about the conquest of Jericho still powerfully emphasizes the meaning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, putting sin out and keeping it out, avoiding going back. We associate these days as teaching us to come out of sin, but also we're quite cognizant, aren't we, that it's possible to go back in and to fail in our efforts to avoid being entrapped all over again. So Jericho, first there was a strategy. What's the problem? It must have mystified a number of military forces or armies over a period of time. And the city of Jericho, whatever its size may have been, was one of the key cities in the Jordan Valley, in that plain. Now, two of the others had been destroyed about 400 years earlier. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed about 400 years earlier than the time, when Israel was going into the promised land. And here they encountered the city of Jericho. How to conquer the seemingly unconquerable and superbly designed fortress city of Jericho? Now, you think about some of the other cities that are mentioned in the Bible, about Babylon, and you read a little bit about how that was undone, that city of Babylon, when it was conquered. Well, Jericho had a special thing going for it as far as how it was constructed. And all the enemies, all those who were would-be conquerors, had failed to that point. And we'll find out why they had failed. What was Jericho's weakness? No military force had discovered that and was not likely to. Or was there no weakness? Well, it seemed like to many conquerors that there wasn't any weakness. No other nations had prevailed. The lessons that we can learn from the ancient battle of Jericho can galvanize our spiritual growth. The title of the sermon is, Are We Conquering Our Spiritual Jericho? The secret to the success? Not hard to figure out as you read the account. It was God. God did it. Let's go back to the book of Joshua. Joshua chapter 5 is a little prelude to the actual description of the battle. But in Joshua chapter 5, here we have the account. And we heard, coincidentally, in the sermonette, some of the prelude there as far as the experience that Israel had. And they lingered, or were kept, would be better put, in the wilderness because of their lack of faith in God, lack of trust in Him. And so an entire generation, with only a couple of exceptions of those faithful men, died out, died in the wilderness. And another generation was now having the opportunity to go into the promised land. And in Joshua chapter 5, this must have been a very exciting time in the spring of the year as the nation of Israel marched along. And they came in chapter 5, we read about this, in verse 10, to the area on the plains of Jericho. Joshua 5, verse 10. So the children of Israel camped in Gilgal, and they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at the twilight on the plains of Jericho. And they ate of the produce of the land on the first, or on the day after the Passover. That's, you know, the beginning of the days of unleavened bread then. Unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Now the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land. You know, I've read this different times and wondered, you know, since the Israelites were so recalcitrant about so many things, so hard, so difficult to please, did some of them say, oh, no, where's my manna? Where's my manna? Kind of a reversal from years earlier. What's that? What is this stuff? You know, we want real food. As the previous generation had been introduced to it, so a new generation experienced this. The manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. And it came to pass that when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man, capitalized there, stood opposite him. Here was a message delivered to Joshua. Well, let's skip down to the beginning of the next chapter, Joshua chapter 6. Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. Apparently they had provisions to last for quite a period of time. They had provided for that. If they had not, you know, the strategy for a number of conquering enemies, it was just to camp around the place and to wait them out till they ran out of food or water. And hungry people and thirsty people do dangerous things. They get hungry enough, they get thirsty enough, you know, then they're going to venture out and try to find something. But the Eternal said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king, and the mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go all around the city once. This you shall do for 6 days. Now, this would, if God were doing the movie, you know, I'll put it that way because motion pictures aren't so true sometimes, especially when they're supposed to be basing it on a biblical account. They can add here and there and fudge a little bit. But if God were doing the movie, this would be just spectacular. And to see expressions on faces, you know, imagine this in the 7 days. And here, following God's instructions that he had given to Joshua and Joshua passed on, they went around the city. And here's what they were supposed to do. And 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priest shall blow the trumpets. Now, what do you think was the situation the very first day for the citizens of Jericho? What is this? This doesn't look like an army. And what are these instruments? What's going on out here? What's with these people, these Israelites? And so then they must have curiously observed this, probably talking with one another and saying, yeah, these guys are really something. They think that this is going to scare us, this to come out, let them kill us, or you know, what would their thoughts have been? Can imagine. They must have thought, this looks pretty ridiculous. We've never seen this before. And all those that have tried to conquer our city over the years. And so that first day, they went around one time. The next day, one time. And then the citizens must have thought, well, is that it? Well, they've just inspected us from a distance to see that they might as well give up. And so they won't be here today. Maybe some of them thought that. But day after day, this must have produced some kind of result in the minds of the citizens. Now, it does say in the account here that they were concerned because what the God of Israel had done. They didn't seem to be particularly concerned about the army of Israel and their implements of war and all that. But it was the God of Israel who had given them victory after victory. They were concerned about that. It shall come to pass when you make a long blast with a ram's horn, and when you shall hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. Now, if you take maybe a few million people, what would the decibel level be if upon giving the signal they all shout? You imagine that in a building, even a few hundred people or some thousands of people, like in a stadium, 50,000 to 100,000, you know, could be quite a high volume. But imagine much more than that, perhaps, for those that are surrounding the city. Anyway, this was going to be very unusual. The great shout, and then the wall of the city will fall down flat. The word flat is an interesting word here. Because the way that it was constructed, it was most improbable, almost impossible, for it to fall down flat. Because it wasn't just upright like this, and a strong force hits it and down it goes. It was broad. So it's pretty hard. Like if you had a foundation, you know, and that foundation is like for a house, and it's just concrete foundation or whatever, and it's up on level area across there, and then how are you going to get something like that to fall over flat? Well, it wasn't quite to that same degree, but the provisions, the arrangements were really interesting, what they had done. Now, when the walls of Jericho fell flat, it is interesting that unless it's proven otherwise, the Bible oftentimes is ridiculed for something that's, you know, science of archaeology or whatever it happens to be, hasn't yet verified. Then there are those skeptics that say, we don't believe that really took place. I mean, someone said, that city didn't even exist. You know, the city of David, you made that up, or this or that. You know, they tend to be very skeptical. Well, there have been different excavations on this site in its little ways off from the small town or city, 5,000 or so population of Jericho today. But there have been some excavations, and some of them within the last couple of decades that have revealed some very interesting things. You know, Josephus, a Jewish historian, said the first day of the feast, the priests carried the ark and they come around with the armed man to guard to it. And when they had done this for 6 days, the seventh day, Joshua gathered the armed man and told them these good tidings that the city should now be taken. Of course, the citizens of Jericho didn't know all of this discussion that was going on. This is from Antiquities of the Jews section. But Jericho was quite a fortification. And you consider how carefully they made this, when it was excavated, they found that even if the first wall could be breached, the attackers would find themselves trapped inside a pit and looking up at a higher second wall. So the first part, it had a double wall, the city did. The first part of the wall was a towering structure of huge stones, 15 feet high, topped by a brick wall, 8 feet high. So what the excavations revealed was so interesting, because if that first wall could have been breached, that would have only been the beginning of the attack, but it would have been disastrous for the attacking army, because they would now be wide open and soldiers, the military from Jericho on up higher, would have been throwing spears and, you know, whatever weaponry they had down at the attackers. Not a good situation for someone, you know, that's intent on conquering that kind of fortification. Spears, rocks, arrows, and various other things hurt and kill and quickly. So the Israelites camped out there, and all of this that took place, it must have been an interesting reaction that these individuals inside the walls of Jericho had. The final day, the seventh day, by this time, isn't it likely, don't you think it's likely, that the citizens of Jericho just had enough of this? I mean, we never experienced such foolishness as this. They don't even make an attempt. Others have attempted and failed, but they just do this silly surrounding us, you know. But when they saw it the first time on that seventh day, and then another time, and then another time, as it built up, I'm just thinking that they really thought, wow, they're delirious now, these Israelites. Look at this. They're just going in circles. They're going to wear themselves out just doing that. But after that seventh time, then they all shouted. All together in a mighty shout. And as the scripture says, the wall fell flat. And when they examined it in the archaeological project, it seemed like the laws of gravity were all defied, because it just went totally collapsed. It didn't just crumble, you know, so then you have a heap there, and any attackers have to climb up over that heap. But in the most unlikely situation at all, it just fell flat, so they had no trouble then entering the city. And I wonder how much resistance they found. You know, it was such a shocking thing like this. You've heard people say, you know, about things, well, I just can't believe it. I just can't believe it. I can't believe what my eyes are seeing. And it might have been that way for many of those people in the city of Jericho. They just couldn't believe that this was happening. How can this be? This can't happen. We've made all these careful provisions, and no one else has been able to do this. And here, they haven't even touched us. They're a few feet away, or a few yards away, or whatever. How could that be? Probably wasn't any will to fight left in them. They may have been terrified by that point. May have turned, tried to escape. Who knows? We're not given all the details of it. But one of the archaeological reports on this was brought out. This was 1990, so a few years back when this was done. So this was about 4 years before it was turned over, you know, to Palestinian control. And I don't think there's going to be any kind of excavation there. You know, the Palestinians are not favorable to anything that's going to prove the record in the Bible. But here are a couple of the points that they made. The city was very well fortified, just as the scripture in Joshua says. The attack occurred just after the spring harvest. They could see evidence somehow of that. The inhabitants had no time or opportunity to flee with their foodstuffs. The siege was very short. The walls were leveled, and it's the report said possibly by an earthquake. The archaeologists are trying to figure out they were level, but how did it happen? And the city was not plundered. No evidence of that. And the city was then burned. But this became quite a thing to Israel. You'd think that they would be sky high, as we could say, jubilant with such intervention by Almighty God. But, you know, it doesn't take much to spoil the whole thing. And so we find that in chapter 7, Joshua chapter 7, verse 1. But the children of Israel committed a trespass regarding the accursed things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, I guess we go back to Adam if we read it far enough in another place. But of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed things. So the anger of the Eternal burned against the children of Israel. And when you read the account, I won't take the time to read all this chapter, but, Joshua was really puzzled. God is for us. And he's delivered Jericho to us. And now, what's happened? Because God brought about punishment due to this secret sin. But nothing remains secret when God doesn't want it to remain secret. And it was all revealed. And it was dealt with. The problem, though, brethren, is that it doesn't take long for human nature to desire the wrong things. Here, in spite of the warning, Achan explained it like, I looked at this stuff and it's just so pitiful, it's so wonderful. It doesn't take human nature that long. What can we learn from Jericho? We learn not only that Jericho is a type of sin and God performed a mighty miracle on behalf of his people, Israel, but we also learn that it's so easy. It's so easy to want something that we shouldn't want, to think in our mind, how can I make that mine? How can I make it right? Achan must have thought, well, how can I do this and not be discovered? Oh, I know. You know what? I've got a tent. And I can go in my personal tent and I can dig a hole. And I can put these valuable things down in the ground and bury them. Good plan? No. We can't do anything that God doesn't know about. And somehow, he must have pushed that out of his mind, or it must have not seemed real, that, I'm not just dealing with the leader that God has appointed, Joshua, and the others helping him. I'm dealing with what God has said we must not do. And so it becomes a very strong lesson. Now, in 1 John chapter 2, notice this. It is amazing. This is something written, apparently, if the indications are true, that it's believed that it may have been in the 90s A.D. We know John was the last one of the writers of the New Testament that God used. But in other words, this could have been 6 decades from the time of Christ's death and resurrection, from about 31 A.D. or so to sometime 90 to 95 A.D., just guessing at it. You know, how were things going by that time for many of the people of God? Well, didn't take that many decades, 6 decades, before they started receiving persecution. That was early on, early in the book of Acts. Notice about that. And notice the death of Stephen. That's mentioned as well early in the book of Acts. But what he says here is concise, and it's quite a warning. In 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, he said, "Do not love the world, the cosmos, the society." Not everything is absolutely wrong in the world about us, but many things are. many things that are forbidden. If we're going to walk with God, if we're going to live the right way, the world has its glitter. It has something that it says it will offer. For some few, it offers fame. For some, it offers riches. For some, it offers something else, you know, that they can be really thrilled with, at least for a while. But it says, do not love the world or the things in the world. It's like saying, don't be enamored with it. You know, pray for God's discernment and value the things of God so much more than the paltry things in comparison that the world has to offer that are fleeting and in some cases just diametrically opposed to God's laws. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. That's strong, isn't it? You suppose John was warning many of those at that time? I think he was. But, you know, as the time goes on, it's difficult. The world in which we live today seems like it has shrunk in so many ways because of the means of communication. What happens in some part of the world thousands of miles away? We see it sometimes while it's still going on, some kind of disaster or whatever. You know, very different than thousands of years ago. Things could happen and many in another part of the world may not know anything about that for the rest of their lives. Just didn't have the means of communication. They had some, you know, with mail routes like the Roman Empire and that time and different things. But wow, what a change it is today. Well, what the world wants to tantalize us with is out there today. Now, if you've ever had this disappointment that you're trying to find something to watch on this box that we call television. No, it's just, wow. Sometimes you think because of the rating that it's G or that it's PG in rating, well, this is not going to be the worst movie I've ever seen. But, you know, you could be surprised at one scene that they can put in there and get away with. Doesn't seem like they have a very good ratings system. But anyway, the stuff can infiltrate. And what's coming on now in some of the sitcoms and some of the things there is proposing something very different than what God says in His Word and saying this is normal. This is the new normal for individuals or for families or for whatever. If we are taken in by that, we hear about it, see it on television, all that, then can change us. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, that quite well encapsulates it, doesn't it? The way that we human beings are oftentimes entrapped by the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. Sodom and Gomorrah, for example, had all of this, including the pride that's mentioned. You know, Ezekiel 16 mentions a section about that. It wasn't only the atrocities or the heinous sexual sins in Sodom and Gomorrah, but they had the other adjoining things, including this pride, a haughtiness. And the world is passing away and the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. So, brethren, each year we have these days of unleavened bread. We have an opportunity to take a look at our lives and to see how we're doing. And I'd like you to think this week of unleavened bread about Jericho, about how difficult and impossible it would have been for Israel on their own to conquer it. God had to conquer it. Did Joshua really fight the battle of Jericho? Well, not that he took a sword and went out there and started killing them, likely. But God fought the battle, and God had the outcome already there, and the Israelites just kind of mopped up, cleaned up, you know, came in and took care of the situation when the walls fell flat. Wow. What it is that experience in Jericho should teach us. One thing is the problem with self-reliance. You know, God tells us to trust in Him. Trust in the Lord, the eternal God, with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. You know, that's easy to read, but that's difficult sometimes for us to apply. Because we can think, well, I'm not a stranger to the truth, and I know this, and I know this danger over there, but I'll be careful, or I won't do that, I won't do that. Wow, how many times could we be disappointed because we've reasoned in the wrong way, a way of self-reliance. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding, Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. Now, Jeremiah put it this way, Jeremiah 10, verses 23 and 24. O Lord, I know the way of a man is not in himself. It's not in a man who walks to direct his own steps. You think about King David, for example, a man who's described in the New Testament as a man after God's own heart. When he, in a sense, took his eyes off God, when that situation came up and he's looking across the way, you know, in the evening, and one thing led to another. And it was a tough period of time that David went through. Now, God is there to help us. He's there to warn us to start with. He's there to encourage us to turn to Him, turn away from sin, to repent of sin. But here, Jeremiah acknowledged this, you know, what the human element is. He said, O Lord, correct me with justice, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. Jeremiah 10, verses 23 and 24. Now, another point that goes hand in hand with self-reliance and tendency to do that. And I don't know, maybe there's more of a tendency as the years go by. It seems like sometimes we gain experience, and sometimes experienced drivers are convinced, I'm a good driver. I don't get in accidents. Accidents do happen to good drivers. They get distracted. Not because they don't have the skill set, but because they get distracted on something else and maybe are overconfident about their skill set in regard to driving. But pride separates us from God. Here's a passage in 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. First Peter chapter 5, verses 5 and 6. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. All of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. Isn't that an interesting description? It's like we say, well, I'm clothed, you know, to have trousers on, or I have a shirt on, and then the coat and the jacket or whatever. Well, what about spiritually? How are we clothed spiritually? Pride is not acceptable spiritual clothing to God. That separates us from Him. Be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time. So the children of Israel didn't do well for very long, did they? They waited for one generation to die out because God said it would, and the next generation to come along. And it didn't take the next generation very long to make some of the same mistakes. Why is that? Well, because human nature responds to sin. That temptation. Our human nature can respond to that. It can look good. It can look like hey, I can do this and still obey God? Or maybe we can put our mind in neutral, as it were. Just not activated, not thinking. But those are two of the biggest problems. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, let's look at a familiar lesson of the days of unleavened bread. And, you know, we look at that as we prepare for the Passover in advance of the days of unleavened bread. And then we focus some more upon it as the time of unleavened bread arrives. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul had many serious problems to deal with Corinth. You know, they had some strong points, but spiritually they had some serious problems. And he was dealing with one of them. What we have is the first part of 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And then he said, after dealing with the particular situation that was going on, he said in verse 6, 1 Corinthians 5, verse 6, your glorying is not good. So somehow they were having a wrong reaction, a response. They became inoculated, or what would you say? They were just accustomed to a situation, a perverse situation that was going on in their midst. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Whether it's during the days of unleavened bread or some other time of the year, sometimes our human nature doesn't seem to realize this, that a little leaven leavens the whole lump. A little bit of compromise, a little bit of easing off and just say, just relax, you know, rather than being spiritually vigilant. Therefore, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed, Christ the Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness. You know, sin, that's not going to get it. Because the lesson is to come out of sin. Repent of sin. Remove it. And wickedness, it says, but with the unleavened of sincerity and truth. In other words, it takes God's righteousness. God was the main one fighting the battle of Jericho. Without his great power, the Israelites would not have been able to just march right in and mop up the citizens, the army of Jericho. We draw upon this analogy of leaven, use this time in the days of unleavened bread as a symbol for sin. Unleavened symbolizes God's righteousness. Now, consider characteristics of leavened and unleavened bread. Some of the characteristics there as we look at the symbol. You know, sin is a lot more prevalent than righteousness in the world around us. Not really any contest, is there? Not absolutely everything, everywhere is sin. But the world is going, basically, in the wrong way. And it seems as time goes on, it gets worse and worse. And so if we don't realize that this can have an effect upon us, we could end up like one of the individuals, you know, that's referred to as a righteous man, Lot. Remember, we read about him as he and his family were living in Sodom. And you read about how he was vexed over what was going on, and he was powerless to stop it. But it was right there in his city. And you read that shocking description like in Genesis chapter 19. And then ask yourself, did God have to remove him? Was he influenced in his thinking somewhat, even though he was not partaking of the evil? Wow. But he was a righteous man. It was a difficult place to be in. Jesus Christ made the statement, is it Luke 17, I think, verse 32, remember Lot's wife. I mean, here they are fleeing. And apparently not anything like the full family that they wanted to be going with them. Lot and his wife, I love to call her Mrs. Lot because they don't know the first name there. But Lot and his wife and two of the daughters. But what kind of heartache would it be as you're walking away and you know that the others are going to be destroyed? Now, whether they knew how extensive that destruction would be or not, I'm not sure that we can, you know, figure that out. In other words, more than the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Nonetheless, it is a very moving thing. When Christ said, remember Lot's wife, she must have been so torn, so anguished over that situation. You think about her husband Lot and about the daughters. How did they handle it? They may have been talking with one another as they were looking straight ahead and leaving. And then all at once, I don't know if they heard anything when Lot's wife turned around, looked up around, and poof, became a pillar of salt. If they heard anything or not, but if they were talking, imagine that. And there's all of a sudden, there's no part to the conversation from Lot's wife. What would you do if you were Lot or one of those two daughters? You'd probably raise your voice thinking, have you fallen back behind? Are you still with us? Are you behind us? Wow. You know, that's a very powerful reminder. And so Jesus Christ said, remember Lot's wife. You can't look back. Though sin is more prevalent than righteousness, living in sin is easy. You know, it's a way that comes too much to human nature. Right toward the self, the desire to gratify the self. Being righteous, following God's laws, not just in the letter of the law, but striving to follow them in the spirit of the law, that attitude. That's difficult. That's challenging. We still have the carnal nature. And sometimes it's like we forget about that. See, what a situation that is to have that dichotomy going on. If we've repented, we've been baptized and had the laying on of hands and received God's Spirit, then we not only have that carnal human nature, as we call it, but we have the beginning of the divine nature. But in so many cases, those two are pitted against one another because human nature can say, hey, this way, I want it my way. Sin exalts the self. God's righteousness leads to humility. And humility is not an easy thing for human beings. Sin's pleasures are temporary. Remember that passage in, we call it the faith chapter, Hebrews chapter 11, about Moses? Interesting, it says Moses chose. You know, life is filled with choices. Like God told ancient Israel, Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, choose this day between life and death. And he told them which was the right choice. To choose life, obedience to God. Moses chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than enjoying the pleasures of sin. Hebrews 11, verse 25. Wow. What a choice. We can think, well, you know, I don't want to deny myself all of this stuff. You know, not everything is wrong, and I'll be careful. Well, we need to be very careful. Because, again, the principle warns us, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. Some sins start in a very small way. But if it's not stopped, if they're not repented of and eradicated, then it can become extremely serious. Sin spreads easily. It's like wildfire. Just like that description on James chapter 3 about the human tongue, you know, it can talk, and it is what a wild conflagration or fire it can produce. So sin spreads easily. God's righteousness seems to be acquired more slowly. And some of us would attest to that, you know, it's not just the first year. We could have that enthusiasm, and that's great. You know, when we're newly baptized and we're ready now to spiritually conquer the world because God has given us His Holy Spirit. But then we find out that the battle is long. The battle is difficult. Why is that? Well, because that's how we become more like God, by resisting the wrong, by staying away from that, by instead emphasizing the obedience to God, drawing closer and closer to Him. Now, sin is built on deceit. There's so much deceit in the world around us today that we get kind of used to it. In advertising and, you know, all sorts of things, and people's conversations, and deceit plays a major role too many times. Truth is the basis for God's righteousness. Well, sin builds a false image. It's a false image. God's righteousness reflects true character. And for us to become, as time goes on, a little bit more like God is what pleases God. He wants us to become more like He is. So as we go through the days of unleavened bread, think about the lesson of Jericho. It wasn't only the lesson of coming out of sin, but the lesson of then continuing to avoid sin. They were fresh from this successful, you know, energizing, wonderful victory when the bad news came. Someone messed up. Someone sinned. Because the nation began to be penalized by God. So as we go through this week, we need to focus our efforts. And first of all, we have to be aware of sin. Remember that passage, you know, in Hebrews chapter 5, verses 10 through 12. Having our senses exercised, discerning. Because if we don't discern it, we're going to blunder into it. And sometimes it starts with an attitude to discern. An attitude to discern and to resist that, so sin does not follow on its heels. We have to recognize it then. Much of the world is immune to that, and or unaware of it would be a better word. And even in religious circles, in some over some, the last some decades, you seldom hear or read the word of sin. Doesn't that sound bizarre? It's like it's not a good word. We want people to feel good about themselves. So, you know, accept everybody and everything's fine. But that's not what God said. God says He has a standard. And, you know, we have to recognize sin. Then we have to resist it. And sometimes it's tough to resist. Do we know when to walk away? Because the longer we linger sometimes, the more apt we are to be overwhelmed. Resist sin. You know, the analogy of magnetic pull, you know, and how strong it is. You take that magnet and you take a piece of steel and you get the two of them apart like that. And there's no way that you're feeling anything like here that says this is going together. But you bring them together and together and together until they get about like this. And then you see how long you can hold them apart, because there's a real pull. There's a strong draw to that. And in fact, those that study physics and this kind of thing will say that the magnetic pull at just 1 inch apart is 100 times stronger than the pull at 10 inches. 10 inches approximates something like that, I'd say. 100 times stronger when you get down to about 1 inch. Wow. We don't want to get down to 1 inch, do we? We want to put it further apart than that. So we have recognizing sin, we have resisting sin, and, you know, we have to remove sin as well. We have to do this, brethren, and, you know, as the time goes on, make sure that we don't become weary with well-doing. So, oh, I've done this for a number of years now, so I can just relax. No. No, God helps us as we do our part, as we respond to Him with our desire for His way and for Him to strengthen us to obey Him. And so remember the days of unleavened bread. I find it helpful to think about the removal of the leaven each and every day and to eat some item of unleavened thing. You know, some will say, well, I believe God wants us to do that. But some will say, well, hey, I don't like bread, so I'm not going to eat unleavened bread each day. Well, to me, it keeps me more mindful. I don't have to eat a whole loaf of unleavened bread to be mindful of that, you know. Just my favorite Rye Crisp. No, that was my grandmother's favorite. But just a Triscuit or something else, you know. And there are lots of unleavened things. But we are physical human beings, and sometimes it helps us to remember the lessons and remember what we're trying to emphasize by thinking of those things each and every day of the days of unleavened bread. So, brethren, with God's help, we will win the battle against sin and conquer our Jericho.